William. William takes Milo and Fiona to the park. It's a hot, still day, the heat pushing up from the tarmac in waves. As Fiona chats to a couple of her friends and Milo cues again and again for the helter-skelter, William sits on a bench, keeping them discreetly in view. In the late afternoon sunlight, long shadows extend from the feet of the children, dipping and flaring along the grass. Any day now, William will hear back from Nepenthe. He feels strangely peaceful, as if the clanking of the swings and the shrieks of the kids and the cawing of the seagulls are a gentle sonata. He hums along to it for a moment, a kind of Sinatra-seagull medley, before he realizes he's humming and stops. Just in time, too, Fiona's coming over. There's a slight, unfamiliar boy next to her. William knows from Fiona's somewhat defiant saunter, as well as the dog trailing at the boy's heels, that this must be Jack. Interesting choice on Jack's part, William thinks, to seek out his girlfriend's dad, a man who could have been so easily avoided. There are 9 boys here, 5 dogs. Jack and Pickles could have blended with the crowd, but no, here he is. Jack is shorter than Fiona, which seems to be the general rule for kids this age, but he has the same kind of pent-up grace as his whippet. Maybe that's the attraction for Fiona, that or the blonde curly hair, half of it in the kid's eyes. How can he see? Maybe he came over here by accident, thinking he was headed for the ice cream van or the dog shit bin. It turns out that Jack wants to be a policeman when he grows up.
"I wondered what it's like being chief inspector," he says, peering sincerely at William from under his weight of hair.
It's, it was, or it is.
"A lot of hard work," William says. "Oh, right. Have you ever been shot?" asks Jack, apparently thinking that hard work means gunfire.
"No," says William.
"Have you ever shot someone?"
"No."
"Have you ever seen someone who's been shot?"
"Yes."
"Oh,"
says Jack. He looks dismayed.
"That's sad," he says.
"I told you," Fiona says importantly. "He's seen loads of dead people."
"All right, Fiona," William says. "No need to dwell on that." A new thought occurs to Jack.
"Do you ever let school trips come to the police station? My friend did that once. He saw the cells and the evidence room and they dressed up in riot gear."
William looks at Fiona. She isn't looking at William, but casually scuffing a hole in the grass, pretending not to be listening. She's a cool one. Anyone else would be signalling with their eyes, "Please don't tell him you're not a chief inspector anymore. Please don't give me away."
"I'm sure that could be arranged," says William carefully.
And Jack does a fist pump. And then Fiona drags Jack off to see the labradoodle puppy that's causing a commotion by the seesaws. All this without so much as a look at William, who's left with no idea what he was meant to do and if he did it or not.
"He's seen loads of dead people," Fiona said. "Where did she get that from? The television?"
William's never told Fiona about any dead people.
"I used to know when someone had died horribly," Annetta said to Marion in their last session. William was more brusque those evenings.
"Brusque," said Marion, noting it down.
"I looked it up in a thesaurus," Annetta said. "I didn't want to use the word cold, and hostile was too much, but quiet wasn't enough. I needed a word in between the two. It was either brusque or breviloquent."
Both Annetta and William started to laugh. Marion smiled at them. "Laughter is good," she said, which obviously killed the joke, faster than a speeding bullet. Then Annetta said, "What I don't understand is why that
girl. Which is, coincidentally, what William would like to know. Why her? It ended his career. A career that had included worse sights by anyone's standards. Though God knows there can't be many jobs that invite the ranking of horrors. Sitting on a break with Carey, discussing over a Kit Kat what you'd rather be called out to. A tramp set alight, or a parent who'd killed their children, then failed, messily, to kill themselves. He can't remember which he chose. Not that it mattered. After a while, he saw both. When William was chief inspector, a new officer said to him, "I'm struggling to cope. I don't know if this is the right career for me." "Why are you telling me this?" William asked. "I can't tell you whether it is or not." The new officer just stared at him. He looked like he might cry. William did not want this to happen. "You should be discussing things like this with the welfare team," William said. "That's what they're here for." After the officer had left the police force to retrain as a primary school teacher, which William personally thought would be far more traumatic, he told Carey the story. Carey had known William for a long time. They were partners in Brighton when they were both PCs. Carey didn't say anything. He just gave William a strange look. "What?" said William. "What's that look?" "I was about to accuse you of being stuck in a previous decade," Carey said. "But this is your decade. You really ought to familiarize yourself with the customs." "How do I cope?" William said. "That's what I get asked. Like there's a manual, but there's no answer. It's like asking an insomniac how they sleep. They'll have a load of advice for you, but if you ask a normal sleeper how they do it, they don't know. They just sleep." "Right," said Carey. He sighed. "Either you cope or you don't," William said. "Welfare and talking won't do a damn thing to help you." "Christ," Carey said, "just don't say that to new recruits, okay?" That was before, obviously. Before the girl. Sometimes William thinks about the look Carey gave him. There was something knowing and sad in it. As if Carey sensed what would happen to William himself in just a couple of years' time. William's wondered before if the girl was a last straw kind of thing, something cumulative, but surely then he would have sensed it building up. But there was nothing. He'd been fine. Maybe he didn't confide in Annetta. Maybe he'd been brusque at times. But he was able to go home from a violent crime and make a spaghetti bolognese, or help the kids with their homework, then maybe have a glass of wine with Annetta, watch a box set of a prestige drama. But then he saw the photo, the girl. Arm, hand, road. And the shadow came, and he couldn't do that anymore, couldn't get on with it. Couldn't cope. And eventually his behaviour in the office was noticed. The zoning out, the long periods away from his desk, as if he'd be able to hide from a shadow. A shadow. And rather than go to therapy or make things awkward for everyone, force them to keep on carrying him, he quit. It's 10 days since William sent off his application to Nepenthe. He's getting impatient with the delay. His GP isn't sure why it's taking so long either, but could only suggest that William give them a follow-up call if he still hasn't heard from them after a week. In the meantime, William makes an appointment with someone from Sussex Police HR and someone from the welfare team to get his sign-off for the procedure. He doesn't recognise either of the names. He doesn't even know the person who answers the phone. It's only been a year since he left. A year of trimming roses and routing greenfly infestations, sun and showers, blisters, cups of tea, cut leaves piling up, and up and up, apparently, because in the meantime, everything has changed. When William arrives at the headquarters in Lewis, the young man on the gate doesn't recognize him either. He lets William through once he's confirmed he has an appointment and gives him directions on where to park. William doesn't say, "I know," or "I worked here for 10 years," or "When were you even born?" He doesn't linger in front of the handsome red brick buildings or try to catch anyone's eye. He walks straight inside and goes to a room he's never been in before, the room in which former officers go to petition for their brains to be rewired, where Michaela from HR smiles and says that she doesn't see any issue here, given that the incident was 4 years ago, wasn't unsolved, and didn't actually involve William directly. And Lucas from the welfare team notes that William is currently in therapy, which is good, very good, and then sits in silence, as if he's not sure why he was called in at all. Neither Lucas nor Michaela say, "All this over a photo of an unexceptional death that had nothing whatsoever to do with you?" And William doesn't say, "Thanks for not mentioning how ridiculous this is." They all shake hands. Michaela says that William will get the paperwork within 7 days. "Great," says William. "Thanks." He's keen to leave now. And while he doesn't believe in premonitions, obviously he's not an idiot, the fact that he registers his own keenness to leave about 20 seconds before Tim Carey appears and says, "Hall," is, well, premonition-like. "Hi, Carey," William says. After William left, Carey replaced William as chief inspector. William meant to congratulate him, then didn't. It's been over a year since they last saw each other. Carey looks mostly the same. Less hair, more stomach. That's it. William wonders briefly what Carey sees as he looks at William. More tanned? More lean? More emotionally disturbed? "You should have told me you were coming in," Carey says. "We could have got lunch. It's been too long. I mean, I don't want to come off needy, but a pint once in a while would be nice." He laughs, but he's looking at William with something that, if William had to name, he might call hurt. Because the two of them used to be friends, probably best friends. They went about their best friendship mostly in silence, mostly brusquely. But William understands now. That's what it was. "Looks like you found me anyway," says William. "Detective work," says Carey. "It's how I got this job." He coughs and looks awkward. "Anyway, did that go okay?" Of course, Carey knows exactly why William is here. Stupid of William to think his appointment wouldn't be noticed. "Yeah," William says. "All signed off." "Good," says Carey. "And it's just that photo, right? Leona Samways." "Who?" William asks. Then he realizes that must be the girl's name. He hadn't remembered that. Just the pictures of her, passed to him in that morning's daily management meeting. The high tops, a golden black star pattern. The way they lolled at a relaxed-looking angle, as if she was asleep in the sun. The hair bobble with two little cat faces. The way her head lay, so that her face was turned away, her stretched-out, empty hand. The girl, Leona, had killed herself, said the PC on the case. They weren't sure at first whether to consider it suspicious, as she was from a criminal family in Newham, London. Her dad was a dealer, but it was looking like suicide. She was only 12. She'd stolen a load of the dad's pills and overdosed. She'd also cut her wrist before she passed out, as if wanting to make extra sure that she'd definitely end up dead. What was it about the pictures? The fact of the high tops and the little cats having been chosen by this girl, who was no longer technically a girl, was now the body of a girl. The blood fanning out around her. All of it, maybe.
"Excuse me," William had said.
He had got up and gone to the loos, and as he'd sat staring at the "Now Wash Your Hands" poster, the shadow had entered his life.
"Yes," he says to Carey now.
"Just that photo." Carey still looks confused, wary even, but he doesn't ask anything else about it. He talks about the latest news, people getting married, people retiring, people dying. Carey's former boss, Chief Superintendent Rathbone, was one of the last. He died only a few months ago of prostate cancer.
"I'm sorry," William says. He feels ashamed. Rathbone was basically Carey's mentor. The two of them were close. This is the kind of thing that William should have known about.
But Carey doesn't reproach him. When they get to the door, he tells William, that mildly hurt expression again, that the two of them really should go for a drink.
"I know," William says.
"I mean it."
"Keep in touch," says Carey.
William nods. Then Carey goes back to his office, which was once William's office, and William drives home. The next time Fiona and Milo come, it's Annetta and not Judy who brings them. She smiles at William, shyly, over the tops of their heads. Happiness fills him.
"Did you want to come in?" William asks her.
"I can't. I'm driving to Warwick. A symposium on derived categories and applications."
"I hope it's fun," William says politely.
"It actually will be," says Annetta.
"Don't forget your calculator," says Milo,
and they laugh. Half a laugh for Milo, half a release of the skittish, hopeful energy that has collected between William and Annetta. Milo beams at them both, pleased to have entertained, even if he wasn't actually joking. Once inside, Fiona and Milo give him their own news in the usual rush, and William makes fish pie and mash. It's their favourite, but he's made it for the past 3 visits, and he's wondering when they're going to call him out. He peels potatoes, exposing the raw white flesh underneath. For some reason, the process reminds him of Marion Dunlop. The prospect of not going back for more sessions, to sit cringing as the blade descends on his knotty skin, is a relief. To put himself instead in the more businesslike hands of Nepenthe. The word targeted. That was what he liked about their marketing material. Targeted like a laser, like keyhole surgery, expert and precise. A more appealing alternative to being flayed alive. He isn't bothered by the news that Nepenthe has discovered a way to get memory back, or the court case that just got settled. The hysteria around traces, he's dismissed. If a trace does come back and starts to bother him, he'll just go back to the clinic, waving his receipt, and get the trace re-zapped. "What if that's why there's a delay with your application?" Annetta said. "What if they're going to stop the procedures?"
"They won't stop," William said.
"They just might have to rewrite the contracts or something."
"You think?" she said.
William said, "I think if they have an opportunity to charge people for erasing the memory and then charge them for putting it back, they'll find a way to make that work." William looks through to the sitting room, where Fiona and Milo are watching a film about some CGI animals. He can hear them giggling. William's relieved to hear the laughter. He's wondered before if his children will be tough enough in the world. Tougher than William is what he means. But they seem well adjusted. The way they took the news of their parents' separation, for example. They ticked off a few of the emotions on the photocopied "What to Expect When You're on a Trial Separation" sheet Marion Dunlop gave him. Sadness, confusion, anger. But then they'd be talking about cereal again, or some grievance about a purple biro. William lays out a cloth over the kitchen table, tries and fails to fold napkins. He has the urge to make things nice for the children, though maybe it's just adding another layer of weirdness to the already weird experience of being visitors in their own home. He tidies up, wipes the worktops, then picks up his phone. He's got an email. Dear William, we are writing to inform you of your full medical history in accordance with a change to our company policy. Recent developments in memory removal technology have brought about a change in the law concerning our service, and we are now required to notify all Nepenthe Memory Solutions clients of their status. William reads the email. Reads it again. Starts on the fine print. Nepenthe Memory Solutions admits no wrongdoing or false advertising. The original claim made by Nepenthe guaranteeing the permanent removal of memories is not technically incorrect, as memories can be considered to be permanently erased unless reinstated. Therefore, the terms of the original contract... But he doesn't finish all that, because his eyes have apparently stopped working. He can hear the potatoes boiling over on the stove next to him, smell the pie burning, see the kids sitting, oblivious, watching the television. But the words right under his eyes are playing some kind of game with him, dodging, darting, running up and down the page, shrinking and looming, until he feels sick and puts the phone down. Marion said she can't fit us in until next Wednesday, Annetta tells him. Apparently it's all these Nepenthe clients and their families. Everyone's been booking appointments. I don't mind waiting, William says. I don't know what to say to her anyway. The first thing William had done was call the clinic. They said they couldn't tell him anything about the procedure at all because he was a self-confidential client. What? So the memory was personal, William said. Not a police thing. That's correct, said the woman at the clinic. Which made sense, because if it had been a police thing, it would have been on his record. He'd have known about it. But he asked anyway, are you sure this isn't an error? This is definitely not an error, said the woman at the clinic. The way she said it. William realized that all the people who'd got this letter had immediately called Nepenthe to tell them it must be an error. He was annoyed with himself for being people. He was annoyed with the woman for making that clear to him. Well, thanks for nothing, he said, and hung up. In the meantime, Annetta had cried and puzzled over what had happened, and then she concluded that William must have had the procedure after he saw that girl, and it backfired, and that's why he was so... She tried to find the right word. Troubled. William reminds her that it wasn't anything professional. It was something personal. It must have been before I met you, he says. I couldn't have had it done when we were together. I would have... Told me? Annetta asks. There's a short silence. The obvious thing, that he wouldn't have told her, of course he wouldn't have, flares, dies, unsaid, between them. Well, Annetta says, forget when it was. And okay, so it's not that girl. It must be something else. What if your PTSD symptoms are just a weird side effect of that wipe? The wipe went wrong in some way, and the symptoms don't have anything to do with that photo at all. I don't know, he says. Have you thought more about it? She asks. I mean, it's been a week since you got the letter. You still haven't said what you want to do. Annetta wants him to get the memory back. Having decided that a botched wipe must be at the root of his problems, she thinks undoing the procedure will undo the problems. She seemed shocked that William didn't immediately get on the phone to ask Nepenthe to sort out a happy ending for William and Annetta. even more happy than the ending William himself had envisaged, actually, because this time it'll be free. They could spend the money on a holiday, she said.
I don't like it, William says. The idea of getting it back.
But why? Cries Annetta.
He can almost see her agonized expression on the other end of the phone.
Because I chose to forget it, whatever it was. I obviously had my reasons.
He thinks about the William of the past. This William is a stranger. He knew something present-day William doesn't, and he chose to hide his knowledge forever. He did that by killing himself. And present-day William is okay with that. And now he's being asked if he wants to resurrect past William, to effectively kill his unknowing present-day self. And if he did it, brought past William back, would past William, who presumably had his own good reasons for killing himself, be happy about that?
Chose, Annetta says, startling him. It went wrong. You didn't choose this. It hasn't turned out the way you chose at all.
In which case, William says, it makes sense to leave the deleted memory as it is and book in another procedure to wipe this new thing, even if it is a side effect.
But,
Annetta says, it's like a rose bush, William says.
A rose bush?
If it gets an infestation of aphids, I spray it. If I don't catch all the aphids and they start to cause problems again, I'm not going to put all the original aphids back. I'm going to spray it again and make sure they're all dead this time.
But this isn't an infestation, Annetta cries. It's your self.
Not any part of me I recognize, William says. Or want.
You want to insecticide your brain.
I want to work again, he says.
I want to sleep at night. Christ, I want to be a functioning husband and father.
His voice has risen. He realizes it in the silence that follows, how very silent it suddenly seems. It's a while before he hears a small sound. Annetta is crying.
Annetta, he says. I'm sorry.
No.
I'm sorry, she says. I don't want to pressure you. Don't apologize. That's my job, isn't it?
He waits, but she doesn't laugh.
Look, let's talk about it with Marion next week.
Okay,
Annetta says eventually. There's a small, damp noise, as of someone wiping their nose.
I understand.
She sounds slightly more optimistic. William can guess why. She thinks Marion Dunlop is going to see the same thing she does, that past William was fine, and now he can come back. Of course, past William never told Annetta why being past William was so intolerable, or why he'd chosen to die. Because he never told Annetta anything, and so no wonder Annetta can't understand why he shouldn't be brought back to life.
I'm trying to understand you, pal, William says to past William. I know you must have your reasons. But did you have to be such a dick about it?
There are days when William is not at work, and it's not his time to look after the kids. These are not good days. He usually needs to find something to keep him busy. He's cleared out the gutters, creosoted their fences, tiled the wall of their bathroom that's been unfinished for 5 years. Today, he cleans the entire house. Not that there's much to do. William is army tidy. It was Annetta who was, is, the messy one. But he finds work. He mops, dusts, disinfects, goes into the children's rooms and straightens up the unused duvets even, pulling the wrinkles out of the cartoon faces. He cleans his, their, own bedroom last, crouching down to push the Hoover under the bed, where it chokes on something on Annetta's side. He pulls out the item, an old T-shirt with a picture on the front, black and white fractals. William shakes the tiny dust tumbleweeds off it and holds it to his face. Smells of nothing. He gave it to Annetta, their first Christmas together. He didn't even know if Annetta's kind of maths had anything to do with fractals. He'd got her some other things too, nothing very clever or thoughtful. The closer the moment got, the more he was dreading handing them over. Annetta gave him her present first, the 1955 pressing of In the Wee Small Hours. It had exactly the sleeve he remembered from his childhood. "Oh, God," William said, "this is too much. And how did you know?" "Your mum told me, that last time we saw her, before she died. She said how much you and your dad used to love all those old singers, how your dad used to sing That's Life to you when you were a kid." William remembered it. Ercole chair legs, cigarette smoke, wine-coloured deep pile carpet. Textbook 70s flashback. His dad singing away, Brummy Sinatra. "She told me to ask you about your dad's records," said Annetta. "Get you to play some. But I didn't think you had anything like that." "The records," William said. "No, we haven't had those for years." "Well, I don't know. That's just what she said." "I think she must have been confused," William said. "I don't have any, unfortunately. She or my dad sold them years ago. There were rare ones. I think they probably got a lot of money for them, though I wish they could have kept at least a couple." "That's sad," said Annetta. "But you've got this one now, at least." William was suddenly worried. His mum had got pretty senile towards the end. She'd liked Annetta, though. She'd spent a lot of time talking to her. "Did she say anything else?" William asked. "About what?" "About, my dad." "Not that I remember. Why?" He tried to smile. He said, "Just for nostalgia's sake." "Oh, William. I know, it must be hard. An awful accident like that, when you were only little. I can't imagine." "It's okay," said William. "No need to dwell on it. Anyway, this is your first present. It's probably terrible. No, it is terrible." Annetta opened it. She laughed. "You know, there's not much maths merch out there," she said, holding it up to herself. "I mean, it's not like being a musician when everyone buys you stuff with musical notes on." "I'm not sure if that means it's a good present or not." "I'm not sure either," she said, "but I love it." When William looks up, it's night time. He's sitting on the floor of the bedroom holding the T-shirt. He must have zoned out again. Well, never mind. What has he lost? Part of a day he didn't want, anyway. And now it's evening and he can put on Netflix and scroll through the recommended for you section. Not that any of the recommendations are actually for William. Most of them are prompted by Annetta's favourite shows of last year, and so he is presented with a selection of dark Scandinavian dramas, true crime documentaries, and Jane Austen adaptations. William can't watch anything about crime or murder. Nor is he in the mood for unspoken tension, even dressed up in bonnets and breeches. In the end, he puts on the documentary with the least violent-sounding title, which is so boring that he falls asleep. This is a mistake. William isn't usually a napper. Because of this, he doesn't see the nap coming. It's like a cosh coming down over his head. Thump. Lights out. And his nightmares are especially pissed off after being ignored for so long. They've been trying and failing to get the attention of William, drugged deaf as he usually is, drugged blind. Now it's their chance. They get hold of him and force him down flat onto the ground. He turns his head to look at his hand, and there it is. The ghostly other hand, overlying his own. It's holding something, colourful and crumpled. An empty plastic bag. There's blood all round the hand. It's a dream, he realises. All he has to do is wake up. Wake up! He wakes up in a smaller shape. Child William, scrabbling at a door. Behind it, his dad is locked in a room with no air. If William can't get the door open in time or break a hole in it, his dad will suffocate. But at some point, it becomes clear that his dad is dead. He died a long time ago, and William's the one in the airless room. He doesn't shout for help. He already knows nobody can hear him, so he gives in. Yes, he says. If this is it, then yes.